Reich is nothing more than collective mass hysteria, the same mass hysteria which pervades all things related to China in the USA today. However, whether this will ever lead to substantial policy outcomes in the TikTok case remains to be seen, and if it ever did, it would likely provoke outrage and cost Biden a generation of young voters.
Aperture. Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that "we acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental.
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont. There's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day, right there. They took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me, without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, sir?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose, the eye as a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years. Where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
Long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, "Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon, all of them." He said, "Oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble." So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize it. Our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. It had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
They're giving you that for every 5 years.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with three other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lies if they would have told us there was a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We tracked down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard and the wife was watering the flowers and we got our water bill in the mail. And with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang. And you put it over and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention and I started reading through it. And then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me, I can tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So, with 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I'll live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument: it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continue to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh. It
lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I might. There will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview. So we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reached the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic, and you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Yemenis have sued top U.S. defense contractors for aiding war crimes against Yemen. The lawsuit accuses Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and General Dynamics of aiding extrajudicial killings by supplying weapons to Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, a group of Yemeni nationals have filed a lawsuit in the U.S. against defense contractors, including Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and General Dynamics, accusing them of aiding and abetting war crimes and extrajudicial killings by supplying arms to the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. The lawsuit filed in the District Court of Washington, D.C., also names the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed, respectively, as well as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Middle East Eye reached out to the Pentagon, the State Department, the embassies of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and the three defense contractors for comment on this lawsuit. The State Department, Pentagon, and Lockheed Martin told MEE that they do not comment on pending litigation. Year after year, the bombs fell on wedding tents, funeral halls, fishing boats, and a school bus, killing thousands of civilians and helping turn Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, reads the lawsuit seen by MEE, adding, weapons supplied by U.S. companies through sales unlawfully approved by U.S. officials allowed Saudi Arabia and the UAE through the named defendant officials to pursue an indiscriminate and brutal bombing campaign. The plaintiffs are seven Yemeni individuals who say they represent the victims of two separate bombings in the country, one for a wedding in 2015 and then another for a funeral in 2016. In October 2015, Al-Sanabani family was readying to celebrate a relative's wedding when a warplane bombed the area, killing 43 people, including 13 women and 16 children, according to Human Rights Watch, HRW. 1 year after, in October 2016, a crowded funeral was bombed and more than 100 people were killed. HRW reported that the bomb used was the U.S.-manufactured GBU-12 PayV2 laser-guided bomb. Khaled Ali Salem Qaib, one of the plaintiffs, said in a statement detailing the death of his son from the wedding bombing in 2015, I found him under a burning car. He was dead. His legs were cut off, and his right hand was cut off too. He was completely burnt. Some nights when I sleep, I feel tight in my body, and I have disturbing nightmares, and I can't bear to see the scene of the crime since. The Yemeni plaintiffs are filing the lawsuit under the Torture Victim Protection Act, TVPA, a 1991 U.S. law that allows victims of torture to sue for compensation from their tormentors if the accused are in the U.S. The lawsuit names the Saudi and Emirati Crown Princes under the Alien Torture Statute, a law that grants federal courts jurisdiction over violations of international law. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of the plaintiffs by Terence Collingworth of International Rights Advocates, comes more than a month after the Campaign Against Arms Trade, CAAT, in January, said it would be taking legal action against the UK government over its arms sales to Saudi Arabia during the ongoing war in Yemen. Collingworth, a longtime human rights lawyer based in Washington, has worked on several cases against multinational corporations over human rights abuses, including ExxonMobil and Drummond, a coal company based in Alabama with operations in South America. March marks the 8th year of the Saudi-led U.S.-backed intervention in Yemen, and rights advocates in the U.S. have been pushing for a definitive end to American and Western support for the Saudi-led coalition. Earlier this week, more than 70 groups came together to protest U.S. support for the war in several states across the country. Yemen descended into war in 2014. The U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition launched a wide-ranging aerial bombing campaign against Yemen. Coalition forces also imposed an economic blockade on some areas in Yemen, including a sea and air blockade, worsening economic conditions for millions of Yemenis. A ceasefire brokered by the UN took effect in April 2022 and was extended once, but eventually collapsed in October. Despite the absence of a truce extension, major fighting has not escalated in the month since it expired.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remaining vestige of God on earth. I'm very happy and thankful to God that after a relatively long break, I have the honor to see you young graduates again in a face-to-face meeting on this day this year. It is good to hear that several thousand young people have joined the armed forces, and this happens every year. whether it is young university graduates who have earned the rank of officer and enter the workforce, or those who enter the university, receive a shoulder mark and a study. Both of them inject a new spirit into the armed forces in a certain way. Both of these groups of young people bring a message of renewal and stability. Whenever young people enter a place, whenever they join an association or an organization, they actually bring the message of strength and renewal to that place.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The presence of Iranian youth in all fields is promising. So whenever they enter various fields, such as the scientific, economic, political, organizational, and military sectors, they bring with them the positive message of hope, renewal, and innovation. Today, there is a misleading propaganda campaign going on that tries to show the opposite of this. The aim of this propaganda is to imply that the Iranian youth have lost their values, have no hope for the future, and do not feel they have any sort of responsibility. There is a propaganda campaign that is serious pursuing this goal, but the reality of the matter is the opposite of this. What is happening in our country is the exact opposite. Our younger generation has progressed brilliantly in all fields and arenas up until today. God willing, they will continue to do the same in the future. Whether it is to defend their homeland, to preserve security, or to help the resistance front throughout their entire region.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children, and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So if not, you know, apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022 about 40%. Give or take. We can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors. Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A big rally was held in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to support Palestinians in the Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank in the face of rising Israeli settlers' aggression against Palestinians. People from all walks of life came out to express their commitment to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been skyrocketed in the recent days as extremist Israeli settlers under the protection of Israeli regime forces went on a rampage in the occupied West Bank villages, torching dozens of houses and cars. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the upcoming holy month of Ramadan will witness an increase in resistance against the Israeli regime.
We vow to make the holy month of Ramadan as a month of renewing our commitment to defending Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestine. The holy month of Ramadan will be a month of mercy and unity among Palestinians, while we turn it into a month of hellfire that will burn the occupiers and the Israeli settlers.
Israeli forces and settlers' attacks since the start of 2023 have claimed the lives of some 70 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and called on all Muslims to support Palestinians and help defend Al-Quds.
We call on our brothers in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank to remain strong and steadfast. We will always support them, and we demand all Muslims and Arabs to support them in the face of settlers' attacks.
Latest figures show that the Israeli settlers' population in the occupied West Bank has grown to more than 500,000 as of January 2020. This is while some 200,000 settlers reside in Al-Quds. The Hamas movement stressed that Palestinians will remain united in the face of all Israeli aggressions.
We are here to support the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, and we say to the Zionist regime and those who support it that the Palestinian revolution and the resistance will not stop and will spread to all Palestinian cities. This protest is sending a message of unity against the Zionist regime and the radical right-wing Zionist cabinet that continues to kill and maim Palestinians.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them.
Palestinians here are calling for stepping up armed resistance against the Israeli regime in order to foil all plots against Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With
a crippling economy and a local currency losing more than 90% of its value. Many of the Lebanese people dealing with economic hardships are hoping that the upcoming drilling activity in Lebanon's waters will lead to the extraction of gas. We are here on the Lebanese southern coast facing Block 9, which includes the Qana field, prospective gas-rich field where Total Energies is expected to begin drilling this summer. And although it might be a while until the country sees any tangible revenues, many believe it could be the only life buoy for a drowning economy. According to the schedule, the program will continue for over a year, and that they're now waiting for the arrival of a rig that's needed for the drilling operation.
We are very serious about the need to drill as soon as possible and find out if indeed all the hopes and the positive assessments that we heard from and opinions that we heard from the CEOs of Eni and of Total, that indeed we have a promising field in Qana and that we will indeed have a discovery toward the end of the year. That's our hope.
As officials are working out the logistics for the foreign companies, observers remain worried over a potential intervention by the United States, which has placed many sanctions impacting Lebanon in recent years.
It's about time for the Americans to stop hindering the companies. And also it's about time for the Lebanese government in order to stand still and insist on Lebanese extraction of the oil and the gas.
This place could have been a confrontation ground. Instead, it is witnessing unprecedented tranquility. The 64-year-old Jamal Hamzi is a retired school principal who now spends most of his time in his garden. Like many in the southern border town of Naqoura, he believes that this is all due to the fact that the resistance has deterred the Israeli regime from threatening the area.
Lebanon should be able to drill its gas resources before Israel can start drilling operation in the Karish field. That was the equation that Sayed Hassan Nasrallah raised, and if it weren't for this equation, then we could not talk about drilling in Block 9 or achieve the victories we have had.
The resistance is the only hope we have to be able to restore our rights to our oil and gas resources. We were able to get the maritime deal thanks to the power of the resistance.
Total Energies has stressed that the maritime deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime ended a deadlock over exploration activities. But some in Lebanon believe Hezbollah might need another round of UAV operations to get the drilling operation on track. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
It's walkout in Britain as tens of thousands of teachers walk off the job once again. Sapna has been a teacher for 11 years.
Now it just feels like we've got to carry on with the strikes because they're not listening to us, they're not valuing us, and they're not giving us what we want, better conditions, better pay, and all of that, really.
This is day three of a nationwide strike that has forced thousands of schools closed or partially closed, affecting millions of students.
Teachers, like the tens of thousands of others across the country, are here today to make sure their voices are heard. They're part of a wave of industrial action across the different sectors of the economy, all calling on the government for pay rises that match the soaring inflation.
Teachers' unions are also hitting out at leaked text messages between disgraced former Health Minister Matt Hancock and former Education Minister Gavin Williamson, in which the latter describes teachers as skivers. That, in addition to a leaked report last year, that hundreds of schools in England were dilapidated and at risk of collapsing. Despite that and a massive strike last month, the government has refused to budge.
We've actually given teachers the highest pay rise in 30 years. It includes a 9% pay rise for newly qualified teachers and record investment in their training and development.
To the National Education Union, who accused the government of refusing meaningful talks, that is simply not true.
We were offered 5% for teachers at some points on the scale, less than that for others. And because we've had a pay freeze for loads of successive years since 2010, and then a few pay awards that were either below or in line with inflation, that's effectively another pay cut.
The next strike is planned for March 15. If there's no movement on pay, we're likely to see more strikes, not just from the teachers like Sapna, but workers in other key professions, who at least for now, enjoy broad public support. Saeed Puriza, London.
At Seoul City Hall, the families of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and their supporters gathered to pay their respects at a temporary memorial and to press the government to apologize and punish those ultimately responsible. Kim Hae-in's brother, Ui Hyun, was among the 159 people killed in the crowd crush last Halloween.
They didn't do anything before to prevent the disaster, and they're still not doing anything. That's why we're out here. The higher-ups who should take responsibility and prevent this from happening are just shifting the blame to others.
Two separate probes, one by the police and another by lawmakers at the National Assembly, resulted in the indictment of several lower-level police and local officials. The aftermath of the Itaewon tragedy quickly turned political. The conservative Minister of Interior and Safety, Lee Sang-min, initially suggested the disaster could not have been prevented, angering families of the victims. The democratically controlled National Assembly voted to impeach Lee last month. Officials knew tens of thousands of young people would gather in Itaewon that night, yet no crowd control measures were taken. Beginning at 6:34 p.m., hours before the crowd crush, more than 10 emergency calls warned the police of overcrowding.
Holding the people accountable and getting them to resign can offer the families some consolation and honor the victims. But the government is not now taking those steps, as if the government is not responsible for anything. It's shameful.
Of those that died, 26 were foreigners, including 5 Iranian exchange students. As families of the victims and their supporters marched to the presidential office, they again called for truth and justice and a proper memorial to their lost loved ones. Frank Smith, Seoul.
For most people in Gaza, it's just a dream to travel and explore the world outside the Israeli cruel blockade. The new generation has lived almost all its whole life under the Israeli siege, learning about the world only through screens. The longest-standing Israeli restriction on the movement of people and goods to and from Gaza has undermined the living conditions of over 2 million Palestinian residents.
The idea of this festival is that children of Gaza rarely travel abroad, and it's hard to get out of Gaza to discover the countries around the world. We sought to bring the world's countries to our children and introduce the different cultures through a collection of famous Flint statues, food and clothes, cultures in general.
Al-Amal Institute for Orphans in Gaza is an independent non-governmental organization that pursues to bring about positive change in the culture of the community and raise awareness about the orphans and their needs in order to ensure a better life for them and their families.
Yehala from around the world comes as a message to the whole world that Palestine is also part of the world. Therefore, this message reaches the world that the crossings should be open to facilitate traveling for our children and us, so we can visit these countries and communicate widely with the neighboring and other countries.
The Israeli blockade of the occupied Gaza Strip in its current form has been in place since June 27, when Israel imposed a full-scale land, sea, and air blockade on the area. The siege contravenes Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment that prevents the realization of a broad range of human rights. 3 Gaza children died in 2022 as a result of the Israeli occupation authorities' delays or refusal to grant them permits to exit Gaza for medical treatment.
We hope such event has a positive effect on our students, and they are part of the history and the glory, and they are capable of breaking the siege and the Israeli blockade want to break their will. They have a great civilization, and this affects their psychological and social well-being.
The beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza live in a cycle of a struggle, located, imprisoned, and denied basic human rights and needs. Now entering its 18th year, the Israeli blockade created a generation seeing a window to the world outside.
These kinds of events are a glimmer of hope for the children who one day want to break the siege and restore their right to freedom of movement. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Terrorism laundering, a term which Iran's foreign minister's two-day visit to Geneva will be remembered by. Addressing the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council at the UN headquarters, Hossein Amir Abdullahian did not mince his words when it came to elaborating on the fact that Iran had been a victim of an unprecedented propaganda war. He said the rights of the Iranian nation were completely ignored during that war, launched by the same countries claiming to be advocates of human rights.
The role of anti-Iran terrorist groups in the recent crisis in my country was evident. Some states were involved in terrorism laundering while applying double standard. They provided considerable financial and logistical facility to some violent and terrorist elements during the unrest. The UN human rights mechanisms could and should contribute to the promotion and protection of human rights through genuine dialogue, constructive interaction, and respectful capacity building cooperation.
Some European officials in particular, who then took the opportunity to meet with Amir Abdullahian. Several other meetings followed as well, involving officials from countries including Armenia, Indonesia, Senegal, and Venezuela, seeking stronger bilateral ties. Top UN officials also met with Iran's foreign minister, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Boosting cooperation was the key issue in the agenda of this pentilateral meeting. Iran is hosting over 5 million Afghan refugees, but international humanitarian organizations have not been offering any kind of help. On the other hand, unilateral sanctions have also exacerbated the situation of these Afghan refugees. The next session of this pentilateral meeting will be held in Tehran to discuss the situation further.
The UN Secretary General was informed of the efforts that Iran has made to solve the problems in Yemen, and Mr. Guterres demanded that we continue our efforts. Regarding Ukraine, Iran's stance was clarified. Iran is ready to use its potential for initiating a peace process. Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and the upcoming visit of the agency's delegation was also discussed in the meeting.
An issue that was reiterated by the foreign minister during the 2023 Conference on Disarmament, which started on the same day the 22nd session of the Human Rights Council was held, allowing the issue of human rights to be discussed in more detail.
We have several agenda items. We have more than 40 or 50 themes and around the same number of country situations that will be discussed over the course of this session. It is also a sign of the importance, I would say, that states and NGOs attach to the Human Rights Council as a venue to discuss issues which are often not heard in other venues. So it's incredibly significant.
This year marks 75 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years since the adoption of the Vienna Declaration, two milestone documents that continue to guide the work of the Council. But it is very clear that we still have a long way to go. The 52nd session of the Human Rights Council started on February 27th and will continue until April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three Ps: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisum Shahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
In the limelight.
According to a report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Pave bombs, as well as Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians, as stated by the International Development Committee of the UK.